Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good morning. We begin this hour of the show at the state capitol. After a busy week last week, lawmakers go back today for more work in both committee and on the floor. And joining me via Skype for our weekly look ahead at some of what to expect from the legislature in the coming days is Ben Giles of the Arizona Capital Times. Ben, we've talked in the past about the issue of tax conformity. It was controversial even before the governor vetoed a bill dealing with that earlier this session. There appears to be a real impasse now between the governor and Republicans in the legislature. Does it seem as though there's any movement on this issue?
None whatsoever, really. I spoke with Senate President Karen Fann about that issue last week just to kind of get her sense of where things are going. Now, she's not in the meetings with the Ninth Floor specifically on that issue. Those governor staffers are meeting with Senator J.D. Mesner and Representative Ben Thoma, among some other Republican leaders on that issue. And it still seems to be in the, quote, brainstorming phase, which isn't really too encouraging because they seem to have been in the brainstorming phase for the last couple of months now. There just doesn't seem to be any agreement yet between Republican lawmakers, many of whom view voting for conformity the way Ducey wants to accomplish it as a tax hike, would prefer to pass some sort of measure that reduces the income tax burden at the state level for certain Arizonans. And then they can pitch it as, hey, I voted for a tax cut instead.
But in the meantime, it seems like at least some legislators are trying to give Arizonans a little more time maybe to see if there can be some kind of movement beyond the brainstorming phase.
Yeah, Senator Mesner, understanding that these negotiations are going incredibly painfully slowly, he actually sponsored a bill to give Arizonans a little bit of a break, so to speak, at least when it comes to the deadline for filing taxes. April 15th is right now the deadline for your federal and state income taxes. The Senate just approved a bill unanimously last week that would actually delay the deadline for state income taxes by 2 months. And what that's sort of an acknowledgement of is that some folks might not want to file their taxes when the legislature hasn't even decided what the tax code is going to be for the 2018 tax year.
So let's talk about another issue that was pretty contentious last week, which is changes to the permanent early voting list. What did lawmakers do and what are the prospects for this bill moving forward?
Well, senators mostly on party lines approved a bill from Senator Michelle Ugenti-Reda that would basically, the verb you use depends on how you feel about the bill. She would say it would clean up the permanent early voting list. The critics of the bill are calling it a purge because if you don't vote using an early ballot in any of two consecutive primary and general elections, you would be removed from PEVL, which sounds a little funny because the name of the list is the permanent early voting list. We're basically making it not permanent anymore. But Republicans are pitching this as a way to clean up the process for county recorders who are responsible for mailing these. And they say that oftentimes when people move, they don't do a good enough job of updating the state to let them know and that ballots are being mailed out to people who aren't getting them anymore.
Are county recorders asking for this?
No, they are not. But what they have done throughout the process, those county recorders, is try and make sure that they can do things to alleviate the concerns that Democrats have highlighted, which is that people expect to get these in the mail when they sign up. It's supposed to be permanent. So what happens if somebody, for whatever reason, doesn't participate? So an amendment that was added to the bill at the last minute in the Senate does authorize county recorders to send notices to voters if they're going to be removed from PEVL and basically tells them, here's how you can get back on the permanent early voting list if you want. And the amendment also clarified that even if you vote in person and you're on PEVL, that participation does not count towards staying on this list.
All right. So, Ben, we are at the point in the session now when we start talking about the state budget, which is the one constitutional thing that lawmakers have to do. Where are we in the process? The governor obviously released his proposal in January, just after the state of the state. Where is the governor's office and the legislature in terms of coming to some kind of agreement?
Well, we're not anywhere close. And at this point, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not unusual for the budget to really start to be a big factor in everyone's minds until April, towards the end of session, once we get close to that 100-day air quotes deadline that we have down at the Arizona Capitol. But again, speaking with the Senate president last week, she has started to meet at least briefly with her Republican members. So the Republican caucus has started to talk a little bit in small groups about the budget. But we're talking about real basic information here. And they haven't got to the point, at least in the Senate, and I don't believe in the House yet either, of trying to figure out, you know, well, we know what the governor's priorities are. What are the representatives' priorities? What are the senator's priorities? So we're really at like the 30,000 foot level right now. Senate President Fan told me that maybe in a few weeks they'll start meeting more in earnest to try and gather what specific priorities are for those rank and file Republicans. And it'll be also interesting to watch and see as Republicans try to work through the budget in the traditional way. Typically, Democrats are sidelined for this process and Republicans work exclusively from the governor. As of now, that is still the standard operating procedure at the Capitol. But with some narrow divides, particularly in the House, where Republicans only have a two-vote advantage over Democrats, could be interesting to see if Democrats have a hand to play, if you will, in the budget debate going forward.
All right. That's Ben Giles. He covers the state Senate for the Arizona Capitol Times. Ben, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Last month, the Republican-controlled Senate and the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives agreed on at least one thing, a massive public lands bill that passed both houses. It still awaits the president's signature, but it includes funding for public lands and wildfire prevention and reauthorized permanently the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which takes money from offshore drilling and redirects it for things like the conservation of parks and wildlife refuges across the country.
Both Arizona Senators Kirsten Sinema and Martha McSally worked on the bill, according to the Arizona Republic, to address public land issues here. And one place that benefited is La Paz County, about a two-hour drive west of the valley on the I-10 route to California. The La Paz County land deal was included in the bill and means the county will now be able to develop around 6,000 acres of federal land currently owned by the feds.
Here's the thing. The vast majority of the land in La Paz County is owned by the federal government or other entities. Here's La Paz County Supervisor D.L. Wilson breaking it down.
The Bureau of Land Management owns just over 58%. We have the Colorado River Indian Tribal Reservation, constitutes about 8%. U.S. military, which is primarily the Yuma Proving Grounds, is just under 14%. State is just under 9%. And we have several wildlife refuges along the Colorado and Bell Williams Rivers that make up about 6%.
That all adds up to about 95% of the land there. And according to Supervisor Wilson, that has some serious effects on the area's potential for economic development. Here he is again.
It has a number of effects. One is that the privately owned parcels, a lot of it is agricultural land, and a lot of it is scattered out in communities. So you'll have like the community of Bouse, the community of Vicksburg, and federal land in between. So that makes it very difficult to provide infrastructure or any continuity of development between those isolated spots.
Now, this land deal is a conveyance, which means the county will purchase the 6,000 acres from the federal government for development. I spoke with Wilson more about it recently and how it all fits into the larger debate about public lands and conservation versus economic growth. But we began with how this 6,000 acres will now be used.
It's targeted to be a solar development, photovoltaic solar project. The primary objective was to create some well-paying jobs for our residents and generate revenue streams for the county. As a small county with a low population, providing basic government services is difficult. So in looking at the assets, obviously, we have a lot of land in La Paz County. We're about 4,500 square miles, and we have a lot of infrastructure that crosses the county. Transmission lines, I-10, natural gas lines. So we went through a process of looking at what kind of projects we could develop other than the traditional economic development items, which is a whole other story that we've been pretty successful with here lately, and identified solar as an up-and-coming potential. So we identified the 8,000 acres. It's located along transmission lines. It's a disturbed area. It's got a World War II airstrip on it. It's adjacent to gas lines, I-10, and it's fairly flat. So it lends itself quite well, once you think a little bit about it, to a solar development.
Did you put out a bid for the contractors who will build this?
We did put out a preliminary RFP to see what kind of interest we got. We've got some good interest, which is kind of what prompted us in the first place to continue with the acquisition of the land.
So you had to go then to lawmakers and say, we want to buy this land, and this is why, and this is why it's important for the county?
Absolutely, yeah. When I took office, I never dreamed I would need to get an act of Congress passed.
Exactly. So that's something I wanted to ask you about is how often you as a county have been involved in sort of this national debate about public lands and trying to find that balance between conservation and economic development.
Since I've taken office, it's been an ongoing debate. Obviously, with wildlife refuges, the Bill Williams River, the Colorado River, the tribal cultural history in the area, that's always a concern to balance the conservation of the land and the use of the land. And that was a primary driver on this particular parcel, is that there's no identified cultural issues, no endangered species, none of the things that normally get in the way of developing federal land. Very little vegetation, it's disturbed, and in the middle of an area that's got all sorts of infrastructure in it already. Mm-hmm. So minimal impact on public use of public lands.
What was your reaction when it passed Congress?
We're still have the hurdle of the presidential signature, which I don't think will be a problem. But the passage of the land means we've got a lot of work to do. We have to request that it be conveyed. We're going to have to get the appraisal done, the cultural and environmental studies, and arrange the financing to purchase the land. So now the work really begins to make this project happen.
You say that this is for jobs. I wonder if you have the workforce available in La Paz County to take these kind of jobs, or if it will involve some sort of training program for folks who maybe aren't trained up in this kind of industry.
Well, and that's an excellent question. We've have some issues with workforce already because of some success that we've had in the economic development area in creating jobs. This particular site is just barely in La Paz County. It's actually closer to a lot of the Metro Phoenix area. So it will attract workforce from the West Valley, I'm sure, as well as from La Paz County. And the thing about a solar project is once it's built, for the size of it, there are not a whole lot of jobs. So the real benefit of this project, La Paz County, is the additional revenue stream to relieve tax burden on our residents.
All right. D.L. Wilson is a supervisor for District 1 in La Paz County. D.L., thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Lauren Gilger, Steve Goldstein, and Tanzina Vega at our partner, The Takeaway.
Last week saw a major development in the business of private prisons and detention centers. J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest bank in the United States, announced it would no longer do business with the private prison industry. Roughly 75% of the country's immigrant detainees are being kept in facilities operated by the private prison industry. But growing public scrutiny of these facilities and their role in detaining migrants has increased pressure on the industry and those who fund it. On Valentine's Day, immigrant rights group Make the Road New York protested outside the home of J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon by sending a mariachi band.
This is pretty consequential. J.P. Morgan is a leading bank, and they've taken a very public stance on the industry.
Lauren Brooke Eisen is a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and author of Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. And I asked her what the J.P. Morgan Chase move might signal about other big players in the industry.
There are other Wall Street banks that are continuing to fund, finance, and lend money to the private prison companies. Wells Fargo, U.S. Bancorp, SunTrust, BNP Paribas, Bank of America. So the real question is, how will this announcement affect the other banks? Will there be a domino effect? And I think the answer to that question is that you really can't look at big banks as one large entity. You can assume that each bank is considering what its reputational risks are with continuing to do business with the industry. How much is the business worth to them versus the level of magnitude of continuing to do business with the industry? And they're each likely making their own assessment right now.
The Takeaway did reach out to J.P. Morgan for comment, and what we got in response, and I'll read that to you, is J.P. Morgan Chase has a robust and well-established process to evaluate the sectors that we serve. As part of this process, we will no longer bank the private prison industry. How often do banks evaluate the sectors they serve? And is that something that you're seeing more now, given that we're in a dynamic moment in social justice in this country, where a lot of these conversations are now rising to the surface?
Jamie Dimon is the CEO of JP Morgan Chase. And in his most recent letter to shareholders, he's written that our immigration policies fail us. And he wrote, we have a proud history of welcoming immigrants to this country. So this was likely a result of, social justice activism. And something else, there's another reason why JP Morgan Chase may have made the decision it made to stop financing the private prison industry this week. This news came days after Democratic New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who sits on the House Financial Services Committee, publicly stated that she wants to hold banks accountable for their connections to companies that operate immigration detention facilities. Additionally, House Financial Services Committee Chairman Maxine Waters has said that she will call in the heads of the country's largest banks to testify before her panel in April. She plans to hear testimony from CEOs of large banks, including Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan Chase. And what's really interesting about this is that this committee has oversight of banks and is using that oversight authority likely to explore private prisons and immigration issues.
What is the financial relationship between big banks and private prison companies these days? I mean, is that support more important than federal funding, for example?
So these big banks finance loans and they provide millions of dollars in revolving credit to the private firms managing prisons, managing correctional facilities and detention centers. And what's interesting about how these private prison companies are structured is that in 2013, two of the country's largest private prison companies, CoreCivic and Geo Group, restructured to become real estate investment trusts, what are known as REITs. And this leaves the companies with little cash on hand to cover the cost of day-to-day operations, such as overhead costs at prisons and detention centers, staff salaries. This is because of the tax status given to REITs. They are required to pass on 90% of their taxable income to their shareholders. But because of this, they rely on the revolving credit from the large banks. They rely on this debt financing to buy smaller companies called community corrections centers, like drug treatment centers, residential reentry centers, and electronic monitoring programs. And that's part of the diversification that we're seeing with the private prison industry as some states and as the federal government reduce their reliance on incarceration. The last couple of years have seen a reduction in our overall U.S. prison population. And these corporations, specifically the private prison companies, are reading the tea leaves and realizing they need to diversify beyond just sort of brick and mortar prisons and detention centers.
Curious if you've been able to sort of look at what we see happening with JP Morgan, and does the same thing apply to what we see happening with certain universities? Some of them, I'm thinking of Yale and others, Columbia University, for example, have also faced pressure to divest in recent years. Does what's happening at JP Morgan sort of fit into this larger picture of economic social justice and divestment generally?
Yes, this is certainly part of a larger trend of divestment that we're seeing across the country right now. So in 2015, Columbia University became the first U.S. institution of higher learning to divest from the private prison industry. 6 months later, the University of California system became the first public education system to divest its holdings in private prison companies. And it's not just universities. Governments are also starting to divest from the private prison industry. So in June of 2017, New York City's comptroller announced that the city pension fund sold its $48 million in stock and bonds from GEO Group, CoreCivic, and G4S. And a few months later, Philadelphia divested its pension fund from the industry. And other corporations have divested over the years, General Electric, Pershing Square Capital Management, Scopia Capital, and you know, hundreds more companies have started to divest from the industry.
Lauren Brooke Eisen is a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Lauren Brooke, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that was Tanzina Vega at our partner, The Takeaway. Most Americans do not think colleges and universities should consider an applicant's race when determining whether or not that applicant will get into the school. That's among the findings of a new survey from the Pew Research Center. It shows almost three-quarters of respondents think colleges should not consider race or ethnicity in their admissions process. These results come against the backdrop of a legal case in Boston over the role race plays in admission policies at Harvard. Carrie Young, education reporter at WBUR in Boston, has been covering the case, and she joins me. And Carrie, let's start with a little background here. The lawsuit was brought by a particular group of students?
Well, yes and no, actually. The case was brought by a group known as Students for Fair Admissions, and that group includes, or they say it includes, quite a few Asian American students who say they were discriminated against in the admissions process. Basically, they're arguing that Asian American students are held to a higher standard to get into Harvard. Now, Students for Fair Admissions is a group backed by a man named Edward Bloom. And if you remember or think back to a previous Supreme Court case, he also backed an effort against the University of Texas, which ultimately, for the most part, lost in the Supreme Court, and affirmative action policies were upheld there. But yes, this is sort of being brought to court, kind of representing a group of students, but there was no individual student actually named in the lawsuit.
Now, what is this group alleging that Harvard is doing in terms of holding some students to a higher standard than others?
Well, so the explanation behind that, or the argument that the attorneys for Students for Fair Admissions were making, was that it all boils down to, or they were trying to prove their case with this thing known as a personal score. Now, when you go to, or when you apply to Harvard, you get assigned several scores that kind of rank you in different senses. One of them is academic, another one is sports, but one of them is sort of measures your personality, and that's based on a number of factors like recommendation letters, your essays, and things like that. So the Students for Fair Admissions is arguing that Asian American applicants score statistically significantly lower than any other ethnic group in this category. And they're saying, you know, despite the fact that they as a group of applicants score higher academically and in other areas, that their lower personal score is keeping them out. So in a sense, they're being held to a higher standard because to sort of overcome that, they need to score higher in academics and other areas.
Well, Carrie, what does Harvard have to say about all that? How are they defending themselves against those charges on their admission policies?
Well, they're defending themselves with a heavy dose of statistics. Actually, a lot of this trial, in my opinion, is it's really make or break based on a set of statistics and which one the judge will believe. But Harvard is arguing that Students for Fair Admissions left out an important student group or an important applicant group in their statistical analysis. Harvard says the group that was left out, and it includes applicants who, you know, are children of faculty and staff, maybe recruited athletes, and also students who are on like the dean's watch list or the dean's interest list. They say that if you break down just that student group or that applicant group, that Asian American applicants actually fare better than other demographics. So they're saying, you know, if we truly are discriminating, why is it that in this one breakdown we're not, but in this other breakdown that doesn't include them, that we are? So they're saying, you know, it doesn't hold water because it's not happening within all of their applicant groups.
Did Students for Fairer Admissions explain why they excluded those groups of students?
Well, they were saying that that group of students got omitted because they get accepted at higher rates than other applicants. And so they were saying, you know, that that would kind of muddy up their analysis, was how they defended it.
So, Carrie, where does this case stand now? Where is it in the process?
Well, right now, it's in the judge's hands. And at first, we thought the final arguments were, you know, in the beginning of November, but we had a second round of final arguments a little bit earlier this year in February, just sort of rehashing what those arguments that were made in court. And from what I've been told, that was a somewhat unusual step for the judge to do. But I've also heard that it also shows the importance of this trial and what it can mean in the long run. You know, I think Judge Burroughs, the judge that oversaw this case or heard the case, she realizes that this is something that's going to go on to the Supreme Court. And what she has to say and how she determines the case, you know, is going to carry a lot of weight. So by rehearing these arguments, it just sort of showed how important that she understood the details, that she understood the logic for the different statistical analyses so that she could make the best decision, you know, before it most likely gets appealed again.
Carrie, how is this case playing in the greater Boston area? I mean, what are Harvard alums, what are Boston residents saying and thinking about this case?
Well, it really depends on who you ask. The students that I've talked to at Harvard, for the most part, are pretty pro-affirmative action. You know, a lot of times students, especially the minority students that I talked to, said, you know, to not consider my race in admissions is to not consider me. But, you know, other people hold different opinions. I talked to a group of parents who came to watch the trial on a regular basis. They were from Lexington, which is a suburb outside of Boston. And they were saying, you know, that it's sort of an open secret that their children, and these parents were Chinese American, they were saying that, you know, it's kind of unfair. They think that their students seem to be held to a higher standard for admissions for a lot of things. So they said that they saw the value in having affirmative action policies, but they just wish it didn't, in their opinion, impact their children the way it did.
All right. That's Carrie Young, the education reporter at WBUR in Boston. Carrie, as always, very good to talk to you. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mark. Good to talk to you.
And now it's time for the quiz show. That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster, who has won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he plays one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our senior producer, Annika Klein. This week, he's playing fellow senior producer Paige Phelps in a special game of Arizona-themed trivia. Last week, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two winning entries. The puzzle was, this five-letter word becomes shorter when you add two letters to it. The answer is, of course, short, which I didn't get, but I think a lot of people did. So our randomly selected winners this week are Eric Lewis and Allie Evans. Leszek will play on behalf of Eric, and Paige will play on behalf of Allie. Whoever wins will get a special KJZZ item.
So I did want to start with how long you've both lived in Arizona. Leszek, you're in northern Arizona right now. That's where we're talking to you from. How long have you been in the state?
I moved to Arizona in December of 1990. So I've been here for, God, it's been close to 29 years now.
Okay, a little longer than you've lived here, right, Paige?
Oh, yes. I've only gone through two summers. That's how I count it here. That's how I mark time.
Yes, you age very quickly in the heat, I know.
Well, fortunately, Paige has been working as a producer for the show here on KJZZ, so I feel like your knowledge of Arizona has probably pretty rapidly grown during that time. But we'll start with you. So go ahead, Paige, answer this question.
Oh, okay.
Arizona trivia. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth Reinhold was an amazing Arizonan. She was born in 1902, and she was famous for being one of the first women in the state to do what?
Well, now, first I want to say that this is only reminding me of Judge Reinhold from Night Court, so that's not a good sign.
This has nothing to do with that, I can tell you. And also, I may have failed to mention that this is multiple choice.
Okay.
So you get
good
to pick one.
Okay.
So Ruth Reinhold was famous for growing cotton, flying a plane, or hiking the Grand Canyon rim to rim?
I'm going to go with flying a plane.
Yes. She was one of the first female pilots in Arizona, and she flew out of a cow pasture that became Sky Harbor International Airport.
All right.
So, Leszek, we as Arizona are not the only state with a place called Phoenix. Ours is probably the most aptly named because it's so hot. But what other chilly state also has a Phoenix? Is it Michigan, Rhode Island, or South Dakota?
Once again, complete guess. I would guess South Dakota.
It's actually Michigan.
Oh, my God. I knew that.
You knew that?
I did.
How in the world did you know that?
Because I've seen that name, and I thought, that's a funny name for a town in Michigan.
Absolutely it is. So it's located on the northern tip of Michigan. I think it might even be a ghost town, as I was researching earlier. But they do get a lot of snow. So don't let anyone tell you it doesn't snow in Phoenix, because technically it does. All right, so Paige, you have one up on Leszek so far.
What?
Really exciting for your first time. This question's for you.
Okay.
The state insect of Arizona is the two-tailed swallowtail butterfly. Don't know if you knew that. It's really pretty, but I want to know what the butterfly's coloration is on its wings. I know, she's giving me a look right now. Green with a black border. Pink with white spots, or yellow with black stripes? What do you think?
What's the name of the butterfly again?
The two-tailed swallowtail butterfly. So it really could be anything.
I'm going to say the green.
It's actually yellow with black stripes.
Oh, that was my
And I knew that one. I've seen them around floating around here in Flagstaff.
Oh, how pretty.
And so when you see them, are you like, yes, that's a two-tailed swallowtail butterfly? Or are you just like, oh, that's a pretty butterfly?
Both.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Let's see here. We've got Paige still up by one. Leszek, let's see if you can recover with this next question. We've been hearing a ton about the Grand Canyon lately, right? Because it's the centennial. This question is not about the Grand Canyon. It's about a lesser known canyon in Arizona called Canyon de Chelly. It's on Navajo land. So, Leszek, what does the name de Chelly translate to in English? Does it mean steep climb, rock canyon, or great view?
I've heard a number of explanations for the etymology of the word. There's some people who say it's a corruption of the Navajo word tsegi, which I believe stands for a canyon. So I'm going to say steep canyon.
Ooh, I said, so here are your options. Let me just make sure I have the right one. So it's steep climb, rock canyon, or great view.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't hear that. I'm going to say Rock Canyon.
Okay, great. You are right. The name de Chelly is a Spanish interpretation of the Navajo word for Rock Canyon.
I feel like de Chelly is also like three girls I went to high school with.
Although it's spelled, it looks like de Chelly.
I know.
Which
it does.
we get from a lot of tourists who are
also
like, hey,
saguaro.
How about
That's
Canyon
also,
de Chelly? Is
yeah,
that cool?
A common mistake.
Right, and saguaro. Paige is learning as a non native. Paige is learning. Leszek, we've got one for you, and Paige has one. So we're down to the final couple questions, and it's a tie already. I'm so excited. That means we'll actually get use out of this trivia research that I did. Okay, Paige. In 1857, there was a crew of surveyors. They set out to create a path for wagons, and it would later become part of Route 66. But they imported something really interesting from another country to help them out. Did they import machetes to help clear the way, camels to carry supplies, or rations of coffee to help keep them awake longer?
You know, I think it should be Red Bull, but I do believe it's camels.
It is.
It's camels!
What?
I love that you both knew that, too. You're Arizona experts.
It's the Beale Road. There are sections of it that run right past Flagstaff.
Absolutely. I mean, we'll have to do a whole segment about that sometime. I think that's fascinating.
There was actually a movie about that, a very terrible movie called Humps.
No,
back in the 70s.
Stop. That's a terrible name.
Well, fortunately, they did abandon that experiment. It was called the United States Camel Corps, if you can believe it. And they wanted to see how camels fared as pack animals in the Southwest. But as we know today, you have to go to the zoo if you want to see camels here. So, Paige, you've got 2 points. Leszek, let's see if you can get this one right as well. Otherwise, Paige wins. If you get it right, we'll go to the tie question. So, this question is, of course, about the Arizona heat, which is a dry heat, as we all know. But which city here gets the honor of holding the hottest recorded temperature in the state? Is it Phoenix or Lake Havasu City or Yuma?
I'm pretty sure it's not Phoenix. I think I remember hearing that it's Yuma.
It's actually Lake Havasu City. Yes.
I should remember that. I was in Phoenix at the time. So.
Were you?
Oh, really? Yeah. And you were like, oh, it's so cool here.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I believe on that same day I was helping my my girlfriend move out of her house, and that was not fun.
Wow.
And it was only 115. Well, we will see if we break that record this summer and the trivia question changes. But in the meantime, Paige, you are victorious.
Congratulations.
I'm so excited. Right now she's placing a wreath of flowers around my neck. It's really beautiful.
Congratulations to this week's winner, Allie Evans. We'll keep bringing Leszek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
And we start this hour of the show with our regular check-in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. A trio of bills in the Arizona legislature could, if passed and then signed by the governor, make it easier for residents to opt out of vaccinations for their kids. Arizona is already among states that permit an expanded number of vaccine-related exemptions, and there are current examples right now in the state of measles and mumps cases. Phil Boas of the Arizona Republic is with me for his appearance to talk about vaccinations and a recent column that called for some teens to be able to opt in. So, Phil, what's the current scope of vaccinations and related concerns in Arizona?
Well, it's interesting. On Friday, we had the first report of the first measles case in Arizona, and we know that it was a child in Pima County who had recently traveled by aircraft to Asia and returned and developed the symptoms of measles. And I think that's instructive. I've been writing a column about this, about what our future looks like, because our world has grown much more international. Mm-hmm. The United States is much more diverse. We're traveling a lot more. Air travel is only going to increase. In fact, it's going to double around the world in the next decade. So we're only going to see more of this. And air travel is how we have contact with some of these diseases that we had eradicated in the United States. So the potential of contact and coming back are high, and that means we need to keep our guard up.
When it comes to keeping our guard up, at what point does the responsibility to society outweigh the responsibility to one's own belief system?
Well, Arizona is one of about 17, 18 states that is more lax on these rules that allow you to opt out more easily. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that we could have these looser laws, and it could handle sort of the eccentricities that were out there. Some of them were kind of religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. That's a smaller portion of it. But now there's this rising anti-vaxxer movement that believes that vaccines are dangerous and they're a foreign body being introduced to kids that are dangerous to them. And that's what that's becoming big enough. It's no longer eccentricity. It's now a fad. And it's bringing down the immunization level. And now it's a danger. And now we got to get tough about it. Mm-hmm. We have to.
Do we allow it to be lax for too long in the sense of respecting people's viewpoints, but maybe giving them too many exemptions?
Well, think of it. So California, we know, is just run by the Democrats and a very liberal state. They had very lax laws, and you could exempt out of immunizations. And then came Disneyland a few years ago, and about 150 kids got sick, came down with measles, and that ended it. That meant they came back and they put in place tough laws. You're going to put your kids in our schools. You're going to get immunized. They're going to be immunized, and we're going to protect the herd here. Washington State had loose laws. They're going to do the same thing. They're in the process of toughening up their laws as well.
Yeah, so briefly with Arizona then, we've seen these bills that would not tighten them. They would, in fact, loosen them. And whether the governor would veto them or not, what's it going to take for us to move in that other direction, too? Is it going to take 150 measles cases, for example, rather than just one or two?
Well, if we keep going in this direction, we're going to ensure that it'll happen because we'll get it, because it's happening around the United States. We're looking at outbreaks now in New York, Illinois, at this moment, in Washington State, in Texas. Mm-hmm. So it's happening. This anti-vax crusade is there, and it's growing in the country. When Governor Ducey said, I'm going to veto a bill that is going to erode the immunization level in this state, he was really making an argument for the Renaissance. He was arguing that, you know, we believe in using facts, in science, in medicine, in reason, in guiding our societies. We no longer rely on superstition or the competing religions to guide that. And so we're going to go by facts, and we're going to protect our kids, because that's who gets sick, and they can get really sick if this breaks out.
You mentioned competing viewpoints, competing religions, whatever it may be in this case. Now, this is going to sound strange, but what about the competition between child and parent? Because now we're seeing some of that, where some of these kids, as they get older and they're able to make their own decisions, there are some examples of kids saying, wait a second, I really wish my parents had me vaccinated, so I'm going to take it into my own hands.
Right. And so we had a piece by a Dr. David Beta over the weekend, who is a chair and professor of the Department of Bioethics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Phoenix. And he was arguing that teenagers who are what you call mature minors, who really understand the ramifications of illness, are in a position, and based on our law, and it's a little bit gray, to be able to decide for themselves that they have an anti-vaxxer parent to come forward and request and get vaccinated and eventually immunize. And so he argues that that ought to be the law, that we ought to be able to treat those kids or immunize those children. I just have an interesting little anecdote, and that is I was going through looking at our letters to the editor, and they were writing about E.J. Montini. And E.J. Montini has been writing some very strong columns about, you know, we need to get kids vaccinated. I was getting all these letters, seeing all these letters from Republicans saying, for the first time in my life, I agree with E.J. Montini. And anyway, so not long after, Montini comes walking into my office with a stack of letters that he had copied out that he was getting. I said, I already know what they say. I'm a Republican. And I agree with Montini.
That's amazing. Maybe that is part of the tide turning then to some extent. Huh?
I think it's more bipartisan than it seems right now from our legislature. I think there are a lot of Republicans who get this.
Okay. Phil Boas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The Brexit clock is ticking. The UK is scheduled to leave the European Union later this month, and this week the UK Parliament will take a key step in determining how that actually happens. With me for our weekly look at some of the top international stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. And Rob, what's happening this week in London as it relates to Brexit?
Well, Mark, the UK and EU hammered out an agreement on Britain's withdrawal from the bloc last year. And that withdrawal is due to go ahead on 29th of March, 18 days from now. But the agreement was approved by Europe and the UK government. It was not agreed by the UK Parliament. And indeed, when it was put to Parliament in January, it was overwhelmingly defeated. So back in January, after that defeat, our Prime Minister Theresa May promised to take her deal back to the EU and get some changes made. Now, though, as far as we know, those changes have not been agreed, meaning that when Parliament gets to vote on this again tomorrow, Tuesday, we're expecting, unless something dramatic happens, a similar result. In other words, a rejection of the deal.
Well, what happens if that deal is voted down again?
Well, if the government wins the vote, then we proceed to exiting the EU on the 29th of March. But if the government loses the vote, as expected, then the Prime Minister says she'll return to Parliament on Wednesday, the day after, and offer Parliament a vote on whether to accept a no-deal Brexit. In other words, give Parliament the chance, or MPs the chance, to rule out Britain leaving with no deal at all at the end of March. And I should say there is a majority in Parliament against a no-deal exit.
So, Rob, that's expected tomorrow. Also tomorrow, a significant anniversary, one that's influenced pretty much everybody's lives, the creation of the World Wide Web.
Yes, it was 30 years ago that Tim Berners-Lee wrote up a proposal for a unified system that would allow research computers to communicate with each other. Now, the idea included three bits of tech speak that have entered our daily speech, URLs, HTTP, and HTML, although most of us can't really explain what those actually are. Berners-Lee originally wanted to call his idea a mesh, but later settled on the term World Wide Web. And I should add, his supervisor returned his paper with the note, vague but exciting.
But Rob, Tim Berners-Lee hasn't been entirely satisfied with the way his idea turned out, has he?
No, he's regularly speaking out against how the World Wide Web has been used. Here he is talking to the BBC last year on the lack of access to the web around the world, as well as cyberbullying.
It would be nice if I could just say, well, actually, the key thing is getting internet access to poor people in sub-Saharan Africa. It would be nice if I could say the key thing is bullying online. But actually, we've got two huge heaps of things. One heap of things is getting all the things involved in getting internet to the other half of the world. And then the other heap of things is we've got people who have the web, but they end up using it to be just joining groups where they just get a kick out of really being really nasty to people, and on a social network that hasn't yet figured out how to stop them.
Tim Berners-Lee there.
Rob, okay, let's talk about one other anniversary this week. This comes up on Friday. It's also affected millions of lives, but not in a positive way. It's the beginning of protests against the president of Syria, protests that turned into a civil war.
Yes, Mark. Well, it was 8 years ago on Friday. Protesters took to the streets in a city in the south of Syria. Those protests soon spread across the country. And of course, this was the time of the Arab Spring. So we had Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, all of them were experiencing popular revolts. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones filed this report in April of 2011.
Protesters in the central town of Talbisa taking cover and taking casualties. These unverified pictures have been posted on the internet by opposition activists. Images from all over the country tell the same story. The protesters demand more freedom, and sometimes the soldiers respond with force.
Owen Bennett-Jones there.
Now, Rob, the civil war appears to be winding down. Bashar al-Assad still in power, but the human cost of this conflict has just been astounding.
Yes, it has. Really astounding. At least 500,000 people have been killed or are missing. And the numbers of refugees are likewise shocking. Up to half the country has been forced to move, 6 million of them within Syria, and nearly as many have fled the country altogether. Some of them are in Turkey, Lebanon, or Jordan. A smaller number have come to Europe, with up to 500,000 in Germany alone. So how many of them will return when the conflict eventually ends? Well, of course, that's an open question.
All right, that's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein, Mark Brody, and Tanzina Vega, with our partner, The Takeaway.
In an executive order last Wednesday, President Trump rolled back an Obama-era policy that set guidelines for how the U.S. reports the number of people killed in drone strikes outside of designated combat zones. The rule change has transparency advocates worried, particularly over how it could limit access to data on civilian death tolls. Jeremy Scahill is a co-founder and executive investigative reporter for The Intercept. Thanks for being with us, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Complicated issue. Let's talk about what Trump's executive order is meant to do.
Well, at the end of the Obama administration, Obama, constitutional law scholar, was concerned about if Trump wins, the trust me, I'm a lawyer,
I'm
I know
a good
what
guy.
I'm doing,
yeah.
Which is how he got a lot of liberals to support drone strikes. He started saying, oh my God, what if Hillary doesn't win? So they quickly put together a set of rules that ACLU and other civil liberties groups and journalists have been pushing for, be more transparent. So what Trump is doing is basically just saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to maintain the secrecy. And, you know, a lot of this is coming from people within his neocon wing of the administration, who are basically saying Congress has no business knowing anything unless we decide to tell them, because under Article 2 of the Constitution, Commander-in-Chief is essentially a dictator when it comes to national security policy.
That's a pretty intense statement there.
Well, this is the theory of the unitary executive, and the fact that Trump now has William Barr as his attorney general is part of, I think, why you're seeing this happen right now. I think Barr probably came on board and with the national security stuff signed off on a bunch of things that had been being debated, and because of the netherworld with Jeff Sessions didn't happen. But let's remember, Obama was no grand hero of transparency on this issue. I mean, he authorized the killing, including of American citizens who hadn't even been charged with crimes. So what we're seeing under Trump, yes, it's rolling back the clock a bit. But we didn't have any great shakes under Obama. From the beginning, this whole thing has been shrouded in secrecy, and Trump is just sort of doubling down on that a bit more than Obama did.
So I want to go back to, I want to follow up on this Obama policy with drones. A producer at The Takeaway here talked to Ned Price, who is a spokesman for the National Security Council under Obama, and he said that the Obama administration's decision in 2016 to start disclosing drone strike data from non-combat zones was less about transparency and more of a strategic decision. Let's take a listen.
Strategic in the sense that for the first time, it allowed the administration to rebut with actual facts and figures the misinformation and even disinformation that terrorist groups and other adversaries around the globe put out in an attempt to undermine public confidence in and perception of the effectiveness and the accuracy and the results of American drone strikes, of our counterterrorism operations around the world.
What is he saying, Jeremy?
Well, he's saying basically when we do a drone strike and we kill a bunch of terrorists, Al-Qaeda will say, oh, you also killed 20 civilians. I understand the logic of what Ned's saying. I think it's based on a bit of fallacy, though, because the fact is that when the CIA kills people in drone strikes or the military, unless a journalist or a human rights organization posthumously proves they were a civilian, the policy of the Democrats, Republicans, U.S. government is that they are enemies killed in action. So if 10 people are killed in a drone strike and the one bad guy you said was the target is killed, until those other identities are confirmed or known, the presumption of the U.S. government is that they were enemies killed in action. So Ned is sort of playing around with, I mean, he's not saying something counterfactual, but he's playing around with what's actually important in this.
How does, first of all, I want to be clear, is this less data or no data that the Trump administration is advocating for?
Well, we've already seen that the Trump administration, when something goes right or they think that they've done some spectacular military operation, they want the entire world to know. Remember when Trump celebrated his dropping of the MOAB, the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan? I mean, it was like the second coming of, you know, of the atomic bombing of Japan in terms of the technological significance to Trump. I think it's dirtier data is the way we could look at it, where it's going to be even more selectively presented to the public than occurred under Obama. And, you know, look, there has been a serious ratcheting up of drone strikes on the part of the Trump administration. Everyone's talking about Trump, Russia, the 2020 race. This guy has doubled down on the worst excesses of Bush and Obama. He has lifted restrictions on killing civilians. In Somalia alone, Trump now has done 20-something drone strikes in this year alone, and he has loosened the rules. Obama wanted to do so-called leadership strikes, where they're taking out known people with a track record in terrorist activity.
And yet he still had civilian casualties.
Oh, he had a lot of civilian casualties, but I'm talking about the stated policy was we are going after the leadership. Trump's not even pretending that anymore. If you are some kid who's getting paid a little bit of money in Somalia or Yemen to basically guard some post somewhere, they're going to treat you in the same way that they would treat Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda. You are a legitimate target. The metrics of that are very complicated, and I do think that there is a direct connection between an increase in support for terrorist organizations and an increase in drone strikes, particularly those that are killing civilians. We saw that under Obama with AQAP in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I think we're going to see it in a lot more places under Trump. This is a dangerous administration in terms of the capability they have militarily and with the CIA, and lying and lack of accountability. Even the minimal accountability standards that Obama put in place in the 11th hour, they've said, no, we're not going to participate in that. This is a very dangerous situation. And I think a lot of us have been making a mistake by paying not enough attention to Trump's war policies. It's bad.
Well, let's also talk about how drone warfare has evolved since President Obama. I mean, this was one of the first times, I think, under his presidency that we'd actually begun to understand how the military was using this. What makes you so concerned? Is it worse technology? Is it better technology now? Is it going to be more efficient? Where do we stand today with drone warfare?
Obama really embraced drones not out of any love for the technology. It was because he didn't want to do large-scale troop deployments, and he spent a lot of his political credibility on a national security level convincing liberals that this is a smarter way to wage war. What we've seen, though, over the past 10 years is that a lot of civilians are killed in drone strikes, maybe not as many as would be killed in conventional Tomahawk cruise missile strikes or ground invasions. But the question is always framed as, should we do drone strikes or troops on the ground, when we should be saying, what does our engagement with the entire Muslim world look like? What is an actual sane approach to countering national security or terrorist threats?
You're talking diplomacy, right? I mean,
well, diplomacy, working with regional partners, and not being afraid to negotiate with governments that say, yeah, we are Islamic in nature, but we pose no threat to the Western world. History is rife with stories where the United States intervenes in countries because they're concerned about Islamic fundamentalism and end up overthrowing the very people that would have been the best counter to terrorism. Bush overthrew a government in Somalia in 2006. No one ever talks about it. Called the Islamic Courts Union. They were the best counter to al-Shabaab, now, the terrorist group now. There's not a lot of thinking ahead on either party's part in this country.
What happened? You said the data is going to get dirtier. Where do people go to find good information, accurate information, cleaner data about what's happening on the ground, if anywhere?
The UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism and the New America Foundation in the United States both have been tracking drone strikes for a very long time. I would say that the Bureau for Investigative Journalism has a very proven track record, and they're very conservative in their methodology. Excuse me. It is out there, but can we trust the source that it's coming from? Under Obama at the end, yeah, they pretty much were straight shooting. Under Trump, who knows? I mean, is he going to start tweeting about this stuff? And that's how we'll find out about it. And is it true? Probably not. It's bad. It's really bad.
Jeremy Scahill is a co-founder and investigative reporter at The Intercept. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
Thank you.
And that was Tanzina Vega with our partner, The Takeaway. The idea of the itinerant bard is often romanticized in film and fiction, moving from town to town and singing for their supper. That's the life singer-songwriter Savannah King chose when she gave up a rooted life for one on the road. Several years ago, she quit her day job to fully dedicate herself to her music, and she left her hometown of Buffalo, New York, and headed west. Today, she lives out of her camper van with her boyfriend here in Arizona most of the year, the youngest snowbirds in the valley. And King is featured in our latest Tiny Desert concert, this time at the farm at South Mountain. There, among the fields and chickens, we talked about how the traveling life in Arizona have changed her music. And I started off by asking what it's like to live the nomadic van life.
Well, I always say that we're the luxurious side of van life. We're more a complete RV because we have a refrigerator, we have heat, we have running water, there's even a toilet and a shower in there, and we totally renovated it, and we put new hardwood floors in, new counters. We really made it home. We've taken it to Florida and Texas and Colorado, but it doesn't matter where the van is parked. When I get in, it's home. It's where all my things are. It's where my guitar is. And that is a strange dynamic to be in Mexico and you wake up in your own bed. You drink coffee out of the same coffee mug that you always drink it out of every morning. But you open the doors and there's the ocean.
What's the nomadic life like, and how has that sort of constant travel affected the way that you write and think about music?
The constant travel can be hard sometimes when we're moving really quickly on tour, but we have learned how to slow down. When we first moved into the van, we were moving really, really quickly because we were excited to be able to tour. So now we slow down. We spend our winter in Phoenix. We'll spend most of our summer back in Buffalo. And it's kind of just allowed me to appreciate what I'm doing, because it can get really overwhelming. It can get difficult to have alone time to write when every day you wake up and you're driving 200 miles to the next show. So we've had to really learn to take that time for ourselves to be able to create.
All right, so you're going to play a song for us now. Which song are we going to hear?
I'm going to play Cliff Rose.
So let's talk about the new album. This is largely inspired by your travels in the Southwest and by the desert here. What is it about this landscape and this place that makes you want to write songs?
I think for me, initially, it was that it's the opposite of what I grew up in. And when I got here and I kind of felt the energy, I think, that is out here, it was so new that it was immediately inspiring for me. And the album is called Cliff Rose, and it came from a book that I was reading by Edward Abbey called Desert Solitaire. And he was talking about how the desert is so much different than the forest, that each thing that grows in the desert has to kind of fight to survive, and that it has a purpose. And I was reading about the cliff rose and how it's so beautiful in a landscape that it almost shouldn't be able to grow in. And I thought that was just fascinating.
So as you're releasing this new album and thinking about what you want to say with it, tell us a little bit about the intentionality in the music and the way in which you're trying to communicate that message with just you and a guitar. Like, this is very pared down in that way.
I think the people that we met on the road and the other people living in vans and kind of living this lifestyle has been a huge influence to me. Not only the nature that we were surrounded by, but just people that think differently and people that grew up different than I did and in different circumstances, and learning about them and realizing that there's more out there to the world than I grew up in. And I really wanted to tell those stories, and I wanted to tell them in a way that just encompassed everything that I am. So the record has a lot of my favorite musicians on them, and I was really happy with the way that it turned out and the way that it said everything I wanted it to say.
All right, let's have you take us out on a song. Which one?
The song that I'm gonna play is Fresh Start.
Used to think that I was the lucky one, but now I know that I was just young. And oh, my heartache, oh, my struggle was to come. I'll get mine, you'll get yours. Scars will grow from where it hurts. Just know those mountains at their core are just earth. If all these years washed away, I don't need back sin. Fresh start, the old friends at my head. 'Cause I would die to hear you sing that way again. To hear you sing that way again. Keep the wheel turning through the years. I can't take it with me. Best to shed my skin.
Ooh. That's Savannah King performing a tiny desert concert at the farm at South Mountain. Her new album, Cliff Rose, is available now, and you can see a video of her performance on our website. And if you are in a band or you know someone who we should check out for another Tiny Desert concert, email us. We are at theshow@kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.